From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
When Wisconsin workers offered a compromise on wages and benefits, but the governor refuses to negotiate, he needs to know this will not stand!
Over 100,000 people take to the streets of Madison, Wisconsin, in the largest protest the city has seen since the Vietnam War. This time, in opposition to Governor Walker's attempt to strip public employees of the right to collectively bargain. We'll play highlights of the rally and speak with Democratic State Representative Kelda Helen Roy. Then the uprising in Libya continues to spread across the country.
We want democracy, we want social justice, we want human rights conventions, international conventions, separation of powers, we want free elections, we want pluralism, we don't want an Islamic state, but we are proud Muslims, we are proud of our traditions and cultures.
We'll hear from pro-democracy protesters in Benghazi and from Democracy Now! Correspondent Anjali Kamat. She just crossed back into Egypt from Libya. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Fears of a humanitarian crisis in Libya are growing amidst escalating violence between rebels and forces loyal to the regime of Colonel Muammar Gaddafi. Anti-government groups have seized control of more areas as they close in on the capital of Tripoli. On Sunday, protesters chained the town of Zawiya, just 30 miles from the capital. As residents celebrated, one demonstrator called for Gaddafi's prosecution for ordering attacks on protesters.
It's time for him to be adjusted. Come with me. We need justice because we have people has been killed, several people. Can you imagine somebody open his chest to pick up bullets and the coward, he shoot the guy. Yeah. And that's my nephew. And he's sleeping there.
Estimates of the death toll so far have reached as high as 2,000. The United Nations, meanwhile, says over 100,000 people have fled Libya to neighboring Egypt and Tunisia in what it calls a humanitarian emergency. Egyptian nationals are said to account for over half the total. A Red Cross spokesperson said Libya's refugee problem is approaching a crisis.
We're very worried, alarmed about the humanitarian situation. As people cross over the border. We are now mobilizing resources as we speak internationally and through our regional office here in Tunis, sending personnel.
The Gaddafi regime has desperately tried to control the information coming out of Libya. Foreign journalists have been brought into Tripoli, but only under government escort. On Friday, one of Gaddafi's sons, Saif al-Islam Gaddafi, denied the widespread violence.
Now, everything is calm, and Tripoli is safe. Today, in the whole of Libya, no casualties, no attacks. Everything is peaceful. So today, everybody is happy. So peace is coming back to our country.
Secretary of State Hillary Clinton's in Geneva today for a special session of the UN Human Rights Council on the Libya crisis. The meeting comes after the UN Security Council unanimously approved a measure imposing sanctions on the Gaddafi regime. This is U.S. Envoy Susan Rice.
We are pleased to have supported this entire resolution and all of its measures, including the referral to the ICC. We were happy to have the opportunity to co-sponsor this, and we think that it is a very powerful message to the leadership of Libya that this heinous killing must stop and that individuals will be held personally accountable.
Over 100,000 people rallied in Madison, Wisconsin, Saturday against Republican Governor Scott Walker's effort to remove the collective bargaining rights of most public workers. It was the largest demonstration Madison has seen since the Vietnam War. Tens of thousands of people marched in solidarity protest nationwide. In New York, thousands gathered for a Save the American Dream rally outside City Hall. Crowds drawing several thousand were also reported in cities cities, including Chicago, Columbus, Los Angeles, and Denver. Back in Wisconsin, hundreds of demonstrators defied police orders and slept inside the state capitol building Sunday night in defiance of Governor Walker's order to leave the capitol. Police decided not to enforce Walker's edict after hundreds of labor activists, students, and supporters insisted on staying put. We'll have more from Wisconsin after headlines. President Obama's hosting a meeting of the nation's governors at the White House today amidst a contentious debate over the squeezing of workers' rights and social services in the name of reducing deficits. At a gathering of the National Governors Association over the weekend, Democratic and Republican leaders agreed to form a committee to explore ways to amend Medicaid. The panel will look at how states can change eligibility rules and other provisions of the insurance program for low-income Americans. Republicans have called for converting Medicaid from an entitlement program to a block grant similar to how Republicans and President Bill Clinton altered welfare programs in the 90s. Among the strongest advocates for that route is Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker, who's just been named the new chair of the National Governors Association's Health and Human Services panel. Public school teachers in Providence, Rhode Island, have been warned they could lose their jobs this year. The Providence School Board issued the work alert last week, citing a multi-billion-dollar budget shortfall. Nearly 2,000 teachers have been told they could lose their jobs, have been sent pink slips. Afghanistan is facing what's being described as its deadliest period for civilians since the U.S. invaded over 9 years ago. According to Afghan officials, more than 200 Afghans have been killed in attacks and military operations over the past 2 weeks. An Afghan government panel is still investigating claims some 65 people were killed in a U.S.-led attack last week. On Saturday, a government adviser and investigator said 40 of the dead were children. Egypt's top prosecutor has issued a travel ban on former President Hosni Mubarak and his family. Mubarak is believed to remain in Egypt following his ouster earlier this month. But rumors have swirled he'll attempt to flee abroad to avoid prosecution for corruption and human rights abuses under his three-decade rule. Large crowds, meanwhile, have returned to Cairo's Tahrir Square for a series of protests. On Friday and Saturday, tens of thousands rallied in Tahrir to mark the one-month anniversary of their uprising and urge the firing of Mubarak appointees in the Egyptian government. The Egyptian military cracked down on the demonstration, in some instances beating and tasering protesters. Republican Senator John McCain and Independent Senator Joe Lieberman were in Egypt this weekend as the first visiting congressional delegation since Mubarak's ouster. McCain and Lieberman met with officials in Egypt's transitional government and even took a walk through Cairo's Tahrir Square, the focal point of the uprising. At a news conference, McCain had warm words for the Egyptian revolution.
This revolution is a repudiation of al-Qaeda. This revolution has shown the people of the world, not just in the Arab world, that peaceful change can come about and violence and extremism is not required in order to achieve democracy and freedom. That's why we are especially proud to be here, where history is being made for the entire world, not just the Arab world.
Senator McCain's comments appear to differ from his stance during the height of the Egyptian uprising. Speaking on Fox News just days before Mubarak was forced to resign, McCain described the popular movements in the Arab world as a virus.
This virus is spreading throughout the Middle East. The president of Yemen, as you know, just made the announcement that he wasn't running again. This, I would argue, is probably the most dangerous period of history of our entire involvement in the Middle East, at least in modern times.
Protests, meanwhile, are ongoing across the Middle East. In Bahrain, thousands continue to flood the streets of the capital, Manama. On Sunday, demonstrators marched to a central court building in their deepest foray into the city so far. The protests come as leading Bahraini Shiite opposition leader Hassan Mushanaf has returned from exile. He was allowed to return after the protests forced the Bahraini monarchy to issue royal pardons.
Promising is not enough. We have to see something on the ground. Just by talking, because different times they had promised before, but they did not do anything for the nation of Bahrain.
Thousands of Tunisians have taken to the streets in celebration following the resignation of the interim prime minister, Mohamed Ghannouchi, a holdover from the regime of former President Zine El Abidine Ben Ali. Ghannouchi has faced constant protests since taking the helm following Ben Ali's departure. At least three people were killed and over 100 wounded in clashes on Saturday. The Yemeni president, Ali Abdullah Saleh, is expected to declare a new unity government today amidst ongoing protests. Tens of thousands of Yemenis have gathered in various cities to demonstrate against Saleh's 32-year rule. Opposition leaders are expected to reject Saleh's offer, which critics see as a last-ditch effort to remain in power. The wave of protests has now spread to Oman. On Sunday, up to six people were reportedly killed when government forces fired on protesters demanding political reform. Protesters set government buildings ablaze and launched a sit-in in the city of Sohar. Sultan Qaboos bin Said has ruled Oman since 1970. And the 83rd Annual Academy Awards were held last night in Los Angeles. The film Inside Job, about the nation's financial crisis, was awarded Best Documentary. In his acceptance speech, director Charles Ferguson drew applause after calling for the jailing of financial executives.
Forgive me. I must start by pointing out that 3 years after a horrific financial crisis caused by massive fraud, not a single financial executive has gone to jail, and that's wrong.
Colin Firth and Natalie Portman won the Best Actor Awards. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Labor protests in Madison, Wisconsin, have entered their third week. Hundreds of demonstrators defied police orders and slept inside the state capitol building on Sunday night to oppose the Republican governor Scott Walker's attempt to strip most public employees of the right to collectively bargain. Governor Walker had ordered the capitol to be emptied by 4 p.m., but Capitol Police decided not to enforce the order after hundreds of labor activists, students and supporters refused to leave. Meanwhile, on Saturday, as many as 100,000 people packed the freezing streets of Madison in the largest protest the city has seen since the Vietnam War. Tens of thousands of people marched in solidarity protests in other state capitals. While it may have been the largest labor protest in the United States in years, the demonstration in Madison received little attention by the corporate press. Today, we broadcast some of the voices from the Madison rally.
I'm Jeff Skiles. And 2 years ago, I was being honored in this very Capitol building as a hero for being one of the pilots in the Miracle on the Hudson. But I'm here to tell you that on that day, there were many, many heroes. Pilots, flight attendants, air traffic controllers, firemen, policemen, crews of the ferry boats, EMTs. We didn't abandon those passengers to save themselves.
Yeah.
We all work together to save everybody. That's a lesson the people in this Capitol building need to learn. All those trained professionals put aside the fear for their own personal safety to get the job done. And every one of them was a union member. Unions help their people do their jobs better. And I'd like to talk to you today about one group that has touched my family's lives. I'd like to talk about the educators in my hometown of Oregon, Wisconsin. These professional men and women who have devoted their lives to develop and nurture our future, our children. And they have given my children and myself a priceless gift. I have watched my kids grow into responsible, intelligent, and caring adults due to their contributions. Just yesterday, my youngest son, JJ, got his ACT college entrance exam scores in the mail. He got a 26. What do you suppose Scott Walker got? That's a good enough score to get into Wisconsin's flagship campus here, the UW-Madison. But JJ won't be going to college next year because JJ is only in the eighth grade. That didn't happen because of Scott Walker. That happened because of the educators in the Oregon School District, and that happened because of all of you. The teachers are only one small collection of voices among the hundreds of thousands of nurses, public employees, state and local workers who will be impacted by this bill. Our federal government has acknowledged our basic right to join together and make our collective voices heard by union membership. The Supreme Court has defended that right. But this budget bill will strip Wisconsin public workers of the protections and rights enjoyed by other Americans. This bill will regulate public workers to second-class status in America. Are we going to let that happen?
No!
Let's not forget how this budget crisis came about. And let's not let this governor and this Republican legislature shift the blame for what's wrong with America from corporate profiteers.
Yeah.
And instead demonize our teachers, our nurses, and our public sector employees.
Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you for coming out. You are an amazing display of Wisconsin democracy. It is a great February Wisconsin day for a rally. And I can tell you, for those of us who have been here for the last 2 weeks, we continue to be inspired by your desire to set aside everyday work to come out and have your voice heard. Oh, wait. I have a phone call. Hang on. I've been trying to get through to this guy all week long. Let's see if he's on. Just a minute. Governor Walker? Governor Walker, this is Mary Bell. I'm the president of the Wisconsin Education Association Council. I know you might not know who I am. I have been walking kind of around the Capitol for a couple of weeks. You might have seen me with one of those signs that says, you know, please stop the attacks on working families. You're a busy guy. You got a lot of things to do. You probably don't have time for a junior high teacher from Wisconsin Rapids. It's tough, but, you know, yeah, Governor Walker, Wisconsin Rapids is in Wisconsin. On behalf of all the hard-working families across this state, Governor, I thought I'd take one more chance to explain why the people, over a quarter of a million Wisconsinites, have turned out to tell you this is the wrong approach. You see, public employees like me, we've already agreed to the financial hit in order to help the state meet its budget shortfall. But it isn't about that. We will not accept taking away our rights. As a teacher, cannot have you take away my say in the lives of my school and my students. Oh, have another call coming in? A call from a Mr. Cook? Coke! I see. Well, I guess if an out-of-state billionaire is more important than a quarter of a million Wisconsinites, I'll have to let you go. Bye-bye. Well, it's a pretend conversation, but it's the only one I've had with the governor, so... It feels like the same one-sided discussion we've had for the last 2 weeks, replayed day after day after day. We send the same message. It isn't about economics. It's about our rights in the workplace.
This is what democracy looks like. This is what people power looks like. This is what union power looks like. And I am so excited to be able to announce all the way from the West Wing to his native Madison. Let's give a shout out for Madison East proud graduate, class of 1977, Mr. Bradley Whitford.
When a governor gives huge tax breaks to corporate special interests that just paid for his campaign, and expects teachers, nurses, and first responders to pay for them, he needs to know this will not stand. When Wisconsin workers offer to compromise on wages and benefits, but the governor refuses to negotiate, he needs to know this will not stand.
Voices.
When a governor lacks the capacity for genuine leadership, and instead uses his budget as a Trojan horse to deny American workers a seat at the table to negotiate their wages, benefits, and safety, he needs to know this will not stand.
Voices of the Madison rally, the largest since the Vietnam War. Up to 100,000 people marched in Wisconsin's capital on Saturday, protesting the anti-union bill of Scott Walker, the governor of Wisconsin. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. When we come back, we'll speak with a Wisconsin State Assembly member who was with the protesters in the Capitol building last night when they refused to leave the building. And then we're going to be going to Libya to hear from people there. This is Democracy Now! Back in a minute.
Monster. First it was the train, now this bill you sponsor. I'm taking what's mine, it's rightfully time. Wisconsin, raise your voice, yo, it's our turn to shine. And with the world watching, defeat is not an option. Holes ain't no barring, this fool out of Wisconsin. Yo, Walker get to walking, unions get to stomping. All the way to Washington, don't stop marching. I was feeling so free, feeling so fly.
Jumpstart by Melissa Zarnik here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we go now to Madison, Wisconsin, where hundreds of demonstrators remain in the state Capitol building protesting Republican Governor Scott Walker's anti-union legislation. Democratic State Representative Kelda Helen Roy joins us now, a Democrat from Madison. She stood alongside the protesters last night who defied orders to leave the state capitol. Welcome to Democracy Now! What happened in the state capitol building last night?
Well, thank you for having me, Amy. I'm delighted to be here. It was certainly tense in the moments leading up to 4 p.m., but when they announced that the building was closed, some of the people who were there chose to leave the Capitol and did so in an orderly fashion, with other of those who were protesting cheering for them on their way out. and thousands of people continued to circle outside the Capitol. Several hundred people, maybe around 600 people, decided to stay in the Capitol. And after several hours of the same sorts of scenes that we've been seeing all week, singing, chanting, drumming, speechifying, the Capitol Police Captain, Chief Tubbs, made an announcement, and he said that the protesters that had remained in the building, they were being orderly and responsible and peaceful, and there was no reason to eject them from the Capitol.
Talk about the role of the police.
Well, I think the law enforcement deserves a tremendous amount of credit, along with, of course, the hundreds of thousands of people that have rallied for their rights over the past 2 weeks. But law enforcement has had a tremendous commitment, and it starts with the Capitol Police, to make sure that the protests are peaceful, nonviolent. In fact, there hasn't even been a single incident of theft, and people have been leaving their belongings all over the Capitol, phones, chargers, purses, sleeping bags. So I just think it's a real testament to not only the people of Wisconsin who have peaceably assembled, but also to the law enforcement that have also maintained that commitment to nonviolence and peace.
We're talking to Wisconsin Assemblymember Kilda Helen Royce, who represents the 81st Assembly District in Wisconsin, the youngest member of the Wisconsin State Assembly. I wanted to turn—
Well, I was till November.
Oh, what happened?
Well, I believe there's a Republican who was elected who is younger than I am.
Assemblywoman,
but I was the youngest member in the last session.
Assemblywoman Kilda Helen Royce, I wanted to ask you about the role police officers have played overall in the Madison protests. On Friday night, hundreds of police and corrections officers marched through the state capitol building, showing support for the demonstrators.
Joel Wagner, the Dane County—I work for the Dane County Sheriff's Department.
Why are you here today?
Because of what Scott Walker's doing. I'll tell you one thing. I was a card-carrying Republican until he did this. Republicans are not this mean. I got to believe that. I'm now an independent, thanks to Scott Walker.
And what is your message to the governor today?
Stop this bill. Kill this bill. Don't be so mean-spirited.
As the police officers were leaving the Capitol, Democracy Now!'s Mike Burke caught up with a member of the Madison police force.
My name is Kristen Devitt. I live in Madison, and I work in Madison, and I'm taking part of this because I've been a union member since I was 15 years old, and I believe in the rights to collective bargaining and the right for us to organize to better our profession.
Now, are you with the police force?
I am. I work for the city of Madison.
And can you talk about why the police officers in Madison and around the state have been organizing around this issue?
We definitely recognize that, you know, whatever happens to our other union brothers and sisters will eventually happen to us, regardless of whether or not they say that we're excluded from the bill. It's going to happen to us the next time we go to bargain.
Now, the governor claims that he needs to make these moves for budget reasons. What is your response to that?
I say we because I feel about all of the unions this way, that we've all decided that it's okay for him to take the money. Take the money, but don't take our rights.
Did you ever think you'd be marching through the Capitol surrounded by protesters like this?
I never thought that anyone would ever try to do this, so no.
There you have Mike Burke, our senior producer, speaking to police in the Capitol on Saturday. I wanted to ask you about this and also about the father of Wisconsin's two most powerful state lawmakers just being picked to lead Wisconsin State Patrol. It's done with Governor Scott Walker's blessing. It's an appointment of Stephen Fitzgerald that will pay him, the father of both the House Speaker, the Assembly Speaker, and the head of the state legislature, $105,000 and boost his public pension just as he presumably nears retirement. Explain the different roles of the different levels of police in this whole conflict.
Well, certainly in the Capitol Police, and on any state property, the Capitol Police have jurisdiction, and they have done a phenomenal job under the leadership of Chief Tubbs of keeping the Capitol clean and orderly and, in fact, quite joyous. But other law enforcement officials have been called in from around the state, police officers from different departments, including our conservation wardens who have police powers. The state troopers are primarily responsible for safety, traffic safety on Wisconsin State Highway, so they have a somewhat different mission than the Capitol Police, but certainly they've been a constant presence in the Capitol and were present on the Assembly floor during that early Friday morning session when the Republicans held an illegitimate vote and prematurely shut down debate.
Mm. And this issue of Fitzgerald being chosen to lead the state police, this remarkable story, given that his two sons are Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald and Assembly Speaker Jeff Fitzgerald.
Well, it's a very politically powerful and connected family, and certainly I think the governor made probably a politically savvy move in appointing the father of the legislative leaders to head his state patrol. I think it is interesting to note that that Fitzgerald Sr., Stephen, was roundly defeated in his effort to run for sheriff. I think he lost 2-1 in the last election.
In one article talking about how no matter Stephen Fitzgerald's qualifications, his appointment looks like a goodwill offering from Governor Walker to the two top lawmakers Walker will need on board with his budget and policy agendas.
Yes. I mean, I think, you know, he certainly has law enforcement credentials, and he might well be a fine appointment, but it certainly does raise questions, and I think it makes people nervous. And then when you, when I've been in the Capitol and seen the coordination that appears to happen with the state troopers, it just makes me a little bit nervous, and I just question whether it's fully above board. Mm.
I want to talk about what happened early Friday morning when Democracy Now! Was there, actually, in Madison, when the Assembly held the controversial vote passing Governor Scott Walker's budget bill. After 15 seconds, voting was gaveled to a close. Many members did not even get a chance to vote. Shouts of shame, shame erupted in the Assembly and were echoed by demonstrators sleeping in the Capitol. Directly after the vote, the Republican members of the Assembly were escorted out of the building by Wisconsin state troopers. Kelda Helen Royce, talk about the vote and the Democrats' plan moving forward.
Well, certainly we were very disappointed that debate was prematurely cut off and the vote was actually not even properly put before the legislature. It was a very confusing few seconds, and I did not have the opportunity to vote. And I think it's wrong that my constituents were not able to have their voice heard through me voting, as well as the majority of Democrats. It was clear that the Republicans had planned in advance that they were going to shut down debate early and do so in a gross violation of Assembly rules, unprecedented in the state's history, and as far as we can tell, in the history of any other legislative body in the country. So it was really it was a premeditated abuse of power and a perversion of our democracy.
Talk about the Republicans who voted. Talk about the Republicans who voted against.
Well, there were four Republicans who voted against this bill, and in the end, it passed with 51 votes. I think that's one reason that you see Speaker Fitzgerald and the Republicans so desperate to shut down debate and push this bill through, because they knew that hour by hour, as the people's voices were being heard and as the media was paying more attention to all the bad things in this bill, they were losing support and they were losing their votes. And I think it's quite possible that had they allowed debate to continue until all 15 Democrats that were in the queue had the chance to speak, they may not have had 50 votes to pass this bill.
State Assemblymember Kelda Helen Royce, I wanted to play a clip of a speech you gave on the Assembly floor, not Friday morning, but on February 18th.
It appears that illegal action was taken. Action started happening before the time that we were even scheduled to be in this body. We had members that were asking to be recognized. They were not recognized. This morning, that happened again. That is outrageous, and it is not worthy of us. It's not worthy of any one of you. Or some of you over there, your hearts are breaking too, because you don't want to do business this way. None of us wants to see this institution and this state take that direction. This is the United States of America. We will disagree passionately. We will raise our voices. We will protest. We will be peaceful. But by God, we will give each other a basic level of respect and human dignity when we disagree. You can win on this, but do not win this way. Do not win this way. I beg of you, reconsider. You will win the vote. Strike the previous action. Let's do this the right way. You can still do the wrong thing, but please, please look in your hearts. Let's do it the right way. Thank
you. Was Wisconsin State Assembly member Kelda Helen Royce on February 18th. And Kelda Helen Royce, where do you go from here?
Well, certainly, those of us who are in the Assembly that did not have the opportunity to vote, we are exploring all of our possible options, whether they might be legal remedies to make sure that our votes are counted and that we, if there is a basis to challenge what happened in the Assembly, that we do so. Because it's unprecedented in the history of the state, we don't really have a clear roadmap. This is totally uncharted waters. But we're certainly going to do everything we can to ensure that our voices are heard. And we're also going to continue standing with the people to try to stop this bill, because we believe it will be devastating for Wisconsin families. That's why we're all wearing these orange shirts, and I have washed it since the 18th. But we are standing here in solidarity, fighting for working families. We'll continue to do so.
I wanted to get your reaction to what Governor Scott Walker said yesterday on Meet the Press. He was talking to David Gregory. Well, let me just tell you what he said. He was demanding that the state senators return home. They, of course, are in Illinois. Let's go to that clip.
For us, it's about the fact that, again, as a local official, I can tell you personally, time and time again, because of collective bargaining, when we had tough budgets in the past, when I was at the county presiding as the CEO there, I tried to do modest changes in pension. I tried to do modest changes in health care. In fact, one year, I literally tried to do a 35-hour work week to try and avoid massive layoffs and furloughs. And the union said, forget it. Embodied, emboldened by the fact that they had collective bargaining agreements, they said, go ahead, literally lay off 400 or 500 people. And to me, laying off people in this economy is just completely unacceptable.
Let me ask
if
you about—
If we do not get these changes and the Senate Democrats don't come back, we're going to be forced to make up the savings in layoffs. And that, to me, is just unacceptable.
What Governor Scott Walker went on to say is that the state senators who have left and gone to Illinois so that they won't make a quorum for the vote to be able to go forward, that they should do what you did, Assemblymember Kelda Helen Royce. You should—he said they should do what the state assembly members did, that the Democrats remained, you debated, and you had a vote. You don't have to agree with each other, he said, but you got to do what you were elected to do, and he used you as an example.
Well, 2 points, Amy. First of all, we stand in close solidarity with our colleagues in the Senate. The Democrats have done a very courageous thing by leaving the state, and they have done what their constituents and the citizens of the state have asked them to do, which is to slow down this attempt to railroad a terrible piece of legislation through that strips away 50 years of people's rights. And we believe, and the Senate Democrats believe, that people have an opportunity to learn about what's in this bill and to stop it. If it was up to the governor, he would have had this bill passed in 5 days. And that is really not a real democratic process. So, I find it extremely troubling that that the governor wants to railroad this through, and he calls what happened in the assembly a democratic process. It was a travesty of democracy, and I can't imagine why the Senate Democrats would come home to participate in a farce of democracy where their voices will be silenced.
And explain your response when he says they should do what they were elected to do, not leave, but debate and vote either way.
Well, I think we've just seen very clearly that the Republicans will not allow for debate. They will not allow the democratic process to occur. They are just hell-bent on pushing through this attack on working families. And the only way to stop them and slow them down is to continue rallying for our rights at the Capitol and to make sure that the Senate Democrats stay out of the state. Otherwise, the Senate will ram this through. Fine. And I want to point out that it's been reported that one of the Republican senators has flipped. And I think that the more time that we have to learn about what's in this bill and for people to really see where people are on this, the citizens of the state don't want this, we have a chance of winning in the Senate. So the Senate is doing their job and what their constituents are asking of them.
Finally, Assemblymember Royce, I want to ask you about the response from the White House to what's happening in Madison. Mm-hmm. Speaking as a candidate in 2007 in South Carolina, then-Senator Barack Obama pledged to walk on the picket line with workers if their right to collectively bargain was denied.
And understand this, if American workers are being denied their right to organize and collectively bargain when I'm in the White House, I'll put on a comfortable pair of shoes myself. I'll walk on that picket line with you as President of the United States of America. Because workers deserve to know that somebody's standing in their corner.
That was then-Senator Barack Obama running for president. Has the response of President Obama been sufficient?
Well, I think he's certainly made supportive statements, and we appreciate that. One of the things that we are doing in Wisconsin is we really believe that this is not about politicians. It's not about me or the Senate Democrats or the president or anyone else. It's about the working people that are going to be harmed by this legislation, the children that are not going to have adequate schools, the patients that are not going to have safe staffing ratios because the nurses have lost their right to collectively bargain. That's what the focus of this should be. So we definitely appreciate the support that we're getting from political leaders, including the president. But really, this is about people. And when you have a governor that cavalierly jokes about laying off 6,000 people and destroying their family's economic security as a way to try to extort we in the legislature to do something, I think you can just see the contrast in leadership between our president, who's doing everything he can to get people back to work and preserve people's rights, and Governor Walker, who will stop at nothing to destroy people's rights, including laying off 6,000 people in an effort to gain more political power for himself.
Assemblymember Kilda Helen Royce, I want to thank you for being with us. Represents the 81st Assembly District in Wisconsin. She was the youngest member of the Wisconsin State Assembly until the last election. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. When we come back, we go to Libya. Stay with us. Marcel Felipe, my mother. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As the uprising continues in Libya, more areas have fallen to the hands of pro-democracy protesters. But Colonel Muammar Gaddafi retains control of the capital, Tripoli. On Sunday, protesters had taken control of Zawiya, a city 30 miles from Tripoli. But pro-Gaddafi forces are surrounding the area. On Saturday, the UN Security Security Council unanimously imposed sanctions in the form of travel bans and asset freezes on Gaddafi and his family. The UN resolution also called for referring Gaddafi to the International Criminal Court for crimes against humanity. In a telephone conversation with the German Chancellor, Angela Merkel, President Barack Obama said Gaddafi should leave.
Resolution 1970 is a strong resolution. It includes a travel ban and an asset freeze for key Libyan leaders. It imposes a complete arms embargo on Libya. It takes new steps against the use of mercenaries by the Libyan government to attack its own people. And for the first time ever, the Security Council has unanimously referred an egregious human rights situation to the International Criminal Court. As President Obama said today, when a leader's only means of staying in power is to use mass violence against its own people, he has lost the legitimacy to rule and needs to do what is right for his country by leaving now.
That was Susan Rice, the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. In an interview with Serbian television Sunday, a defiant Gaddafi repeated his message that he will stay in Libya. Speaking via telephone from his Tripoli office, he again blamed foreigners and al-Qaeda for the uprising that's threatening his 41-year rule. He also condemned the United Nations Security Council for imposing sanctions on him and launching a war crimes inquiry. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is meeting key European allies in Geneva to formulate a coordinated response to the situation in Libya. Some officials estimate about 2,000 people have been killed since the uprising began on February 15th. To get an update on the events in Libya, we're joined now by Democracy Now! Correspondent Anjali Kamat. She's in Cairo. She just came over the border from Libya. We'll also be speaking with Human Rights Watch North Africa and Middle East Director Sarah Lee Whitson, who is in Tunis right now, was at the Tunisia-Libya border. Anjali, tell us about the trip you've taken over the last few days, who you spoke to, what is the situation?
Hi, Amy. It's great to be with you. Great to be back on the internet. I spent 5 days in Libya's liberated eastern zone. The main cities there are Beida, Derna, Tobruk, and of course, Libya's second largest city, Benghazi, which is now—this was the city where the protests began in February, and this is the city where the new face of the future Libya is taking shape. I met a number of people—I'll talk a little bit about Benghazi, because it's really the seat of where a lot of important political developments are taking place. 10 days ago, Benghazi was the site of incredibly brutal violence. Human Rights Watch estimates that 237 people were killed. Several people we spoke to had witnessed very, very brutal street battles with mercenaries and members of Gaddafi's battalions attacking protesters armed with just rocks and stones to defend themselves. Today, the city is transformed, and everywhere there's graffiti with asking people to take care of their city and to try and build a new Libya. Residents have taken complete charge of the city. For the first time in 42 years, people are in a state of shock that they have complete control of their lives. They're in complete control of everything in their city, and Gaddafi's forces are nowhere to be seen. We spoke to a number of people in the city who are members of what they're called the coalition of the February 17th revolution, because the revolution was called to begin on February 17th. In Benghazi, incidentally, it began on February 15th. The coalition is made up of a motley crew of people. It's professionals, lawyers, doctors, engineers, teachers, university professors, workers, a lot of students, a lot of young people who took to the streets, many of whom were killed. The day I arrived in Benghazi, it was Friday, there was a very large demonstration taking place in the center of the city. And the revolution's headquarters are in two buildings, the former High Court of Benghazi and a district court, two buildings right next door to each other, which are right on the Mediterranean. one building, the former High Court, is now the sort of media hub of the revolution. This is where people are trying to set up a satellite internet connection to get videos out to people around the world. Of course, it's been very difficult to break through Gaddafi's internet blackout. But this is also where people have taken control of state media. So the state radio station is now taken over by revolutionaries. It's called Libya al-Hurra, Free Libya, and it broadcasts 24 hours a day across eastern Libya. There's also a new newspaper that's coming out every day called Libya al-Hurra, Free Libya. I have a copy right here. And it's incredible to see, you know, people, both journalists, media professionals in the city, as well as just ordinary citizens coming in and devoting so much time to trying to counter the state media and the false image being pushed forward by Gaddafi and his son about who the protesters are. We've all heard in Gaddafi's speeches and in his son Saif al-Islam's speeches, the protesters are foreign elements, they're linked to al-Qaeda, he's called the protesters rats. I mean, people are very keen on trying to counter this image of themselves. The day I arrived, the coalition had just appointed a city council to manage the day-to-day functioning of the city. Banks had just opened. You know, there's young people everywhere in the streets trying to direct traffic. There's been no reports of looting or damaging property. People are very proud of this. You know, they're trying to move on. They're not people who are used to governing their city. They've never had experience doing this, so they're starting from scratch. There's a real sense of excitement, also a sense of nervousness. You know, people, or I listened to a press conference given by the Council of the Revolution, and the main spokesperson made it very clear that, you know, while they were calling for a no-fly zone, this is the number one demand in terms of what the international community can do, they're very opposed to any other form of foreign military intervention. They do want targeted sanctions, which have already begun, but they also do want a no-fly zone, and people are very nervous about what's happening in Tripoli. And on the one hand, you know, if you look at a map of Libya, you see that really Gaddafi's forces, it's almost like a noose around Tripoli. Tripoli and Sirte are really the only two places that are still in complete control, that Gaddafi still has complete control over. The rest of the country is increasingly under rebel forces, rebel command. So on one hand, that's very encouraging for people that we spoke to in Benghazi. But, you know, of course, people are still nervous. They're worried that there might be a counterattack. And there's a sense that, you know, Gaddafi can do anything to people. And there's a real sense of fear. But I think people are also trying to see what they can do to manage their city and to also support their friends and families in Tripoli, who are now continue to be under siege.
Anjali, if you could introduce the two women lawyers that you spoke to.
Yes, absolutely. So I spoke to two women lawyers who were really seem to be running a lot of things in on the Council of the Revolution. One of them is a member of the Council of the Revolution, Salwa Abugagis. She's the first woman who you'll see. And the second woman is Hana Al-Galal, also a lawyer. She's a member of the Media Committee. And I asked them a number of questions, and this clip begins when I asked them if they expected this to take place in Libya, and in particular to begin in their hometown of Benghazi.
They can't believe themselves, no. For 2-3 days, they can't believe themselves. But Gaddafi, not here anymore.
We can talk.
We can talk. We can
freedom of expression.
Yeah, yes.
And the love.
It's horrible things. You can't believe it. You know, 42 years, everything belongs to Gaddafi and his sons.
Regime.
And his sons.
Yes, yes.
You know, all
he said it in his speech.
Yeah.
I am Libya. There is no Libya without him.
Yeah.
We are not none. And look what he called us. He called us cockroaches. That's how he saw us for 42
yeah.
years. And that's the way he treated us for 42 years. And we are happy celebrating, but at the same time, we are praying for Tripoli and for
yeah.
the
because
the
Tripoli is our country yesterday, today, and tomorrow.
We are calling for the unity of Libya. The capital city is Tripoli.
How is the coalition, the Itilaf, supporting Tripoli? What are you doing to support people in Tripoli
now,
and Zawiya?
Now there's a meeting outside the court here with people from coalition, from Tobruk, Beida, and Derna. Okay, and now they have
having a meeting now, and they are discussing these things, and we will see they will decide about.
We cannot talk so much into the future. We are just living it minute by minute. And this is overwhelming even to the people, the international media, the international community. This is something never happened in history. And we are doing, and we are surprised ourselves, and we are proud, because in Benghazi there is no looting, there is no chaos. Everything is, every person in this country and this city has been participating and protecting private and public property. Everybody is opening his homes for the expatriates. We are doing everything. There might be minor mistakes, but this is normal. We are in emergency, but we are doing great.
And I want to say something else, that everybody from outside, they are asking us, what you want to do? Please be patient. Please. You know, there's a lot of stress on us, okay? Because we didn't plan it in Egypt. When they said that they prepared since 2005 for 5 years, we didn't do nothing, okay? It's like this.
It's the will of God.
Yeah.
In this situation, what is it you'd like from the international community? Is there something that you'd like to see? Some, what kind of tangible support would you like from the governments and from the people?
Mm-hmm. We need their support, and we thank all the media who comes here so they can see by their own eyes that we didn't lie.
Yeah, very urgent demands, and that's what we want from the international world, is a non-flight zone in Libya, because this is the only way they can help us. If the Security Council and the United Nations, they have that, they are helping us a lot, because this is the only way we can help liberating Tripoli, then everybody can come and help and comes out.
That was Hannah Al-Ghalal and Salwa Bougegis, lawyers in Benghazi, members of the Coalition for the Revolution, interviewed by Democracy Now!'s Anjali Kamat. In our last minute now, we turn to Sarah Leah Whitson, executive director of the Middle East and North Africa Division at Human Rights Watch, just returned from the Libya-Tunisia border, where thousands of people are fleeing the unrest in Libya. In this last minute, Sarah, if you could tell us what you are witnessing.
The border has been flooded with foreign migrant workers leaving Libya, overwhelmingly Tunisian and Egyptian workers. There have been about 40,000 who have left the western border of Libya, and the Egyptians, who were about 20,000 of those, have been by and large stranded because the Egyptian government has not been able to prepare the evacuation of their nationals from Tunisia, and they've been there for several days in tents, in very cold, rainy weather, and increasingly frustrated and upset at being stuck after a very stressful journey through Libya.
The numbers, Sarah Leah Whitson, that Human Rights Watch now believes the number of people who have been killed and injured in Libya.
We don't have a formally updated figure since the 300 we gave several days ago, and that's primarily because our ability to contact hospitals parts of the country not under the control of protesters dramatically shrank in the middle of this week when the government stopped the use of telephones and internet access. But I would comfortably, confidently say that it is at least double our initial estimate of 300 by now.
Sarah Leah Whitson, thank you for joining us, executive director of the Middle East and North Africa Division at Human Rights Watch, just returned from the Libya-Tunisia border. That does it for our broadcast. I'm Amy Goodman. Our website is democracynow.org. Thanks for joining us.